Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Craig Lee. Craig is an accredited online counsellor and psychotherapist with 18 years of experience in behavioural change and mental health services. Craig uses his personal experience of an eating disorder and body dysmorphia to support clients to achieve food freedom, enhance their body image, and lead fulfilling lives using his lived experience. In this week's episode, we dive into orthorexia and the normalisation of these behaviours. We also discuss mine and Craig's personal experience of ADHD and how to navigate receiving diagnoses and labels to best support your recovery in life. Hello, Craig. Welcome back to the Full of Beans podcast. It is so nice to have you again. How are you doing today?
Well, thank you. And thank you for having me back.
So nice to have you back. I feel like since we've had you last, you've been through so many changes and your business and your therapy has just absolutely exploded. So it's so nice to see you doing so well.
I really appreciate that. And I do very much want to acknowledge people like yourself who have been so supportive and promoting me, taking the time to speak with me, put me in contact with other people, because that makes such a big difference when you're in private practice, and especially doing what I've done, which is take the jump from having a salaried role to relying solely on my private practice income. And it's been wonderful to connect with so many people like yourself. So thank you.
Yeah, no, it's an absolute pleasure. It's I mean, I think that you're an amazing human, so anything I can do to help. But obviously I went self-employed. I think we went self-employed at quite a similar time.
Yeah.
And I found the same thing. You know, people originally said to me, you know, you sure you want to go self-employed? You know, it's quite lonely out there and things like that. And actually, I think because of the, I mean, obviously we do very different things, but I would say we're in a similar community or similar network.
Yes.
It's such an encouraging, uplifting community of people that really do want to help. And I think that's why I love working in the industry so much, is that it's not competitive. It's, you know, oh, well, maybe I can't help you, but I know somebody else that can. And it's really, really lovely to see people kind of supporting each other and recommending each other where they can.
I totally agree. And I've certainly found that within the sort of eating disorder therapist space, where, you know, you can tell very clearly that people are passionate about what they do over and above income. So I've had other therapists refer people to me just because they thought I'd be more suited to that client.
Wow.
And vice versa. You know, it's a very collaborative space. It's not the kind of environment where everyone's just sort of out for themselves, which I've seen in sort of the corporate world.
Yes.
So it's nice to be in that space where there is that authenticity and that genuine desire to just help each other out.
Yeah, I think you're so true. And I think that's why I was attracted to working in the industry, because it is very much like, you know, at the end of the day, one therapist may not be right for somebody. And I think sometimes you do have to kind of go through a few discovery calls with people to work out who is the right therapist for you. But that's so nice that you can be like, oh, actually, you know, I think that somebody else might be more of a specialist in this area, and I recommend them to you. Because I think what people don't understand is when you have a mentality like that, people are then wanting to give back to you.
Yes.
It's like on Instagram, I always say this to my clients, you know, like, if you share someone's post or you comment on their post to increase engagement for it, they're probably going to be more likely to do it for you, because people want to help you back because you've helped them out. Whereas I think, like you say, in the corporate world, it's dog eat dog. Like, everybody's out to get each other. And, you know, even people that are colleagues are competing against each other. And I'm just like, oh, we don't need to live in a world like that. We can live in a world where we're all civil. We all get, you know, there's enough kind of clients and things like that to go around. But it is a very different world.
It is, and it sounds idyllic, but it's been my very real experience. And you know, I know I'm not the only therapist who operates in this way, but every discovery call I have with a client, I say to them, you know, the biggest factor in you being able to recover isn't what training the therapists had, because you can have the best therapist in the world training wise, but if you don't have that connection with them, that relationship, it absolutely doesn't matter. So I always tell people on the discovery call, if you don't feel that click with me, let me know, because I'm happy to refer you to someone who I trust, and you know, you might be able to have that therapeutic relationship with. And I think that's so important, because you know, if you're just going in there with an attitude of, well, I can help anybody with an eating disorder, then yeah, reality will hit you in the face very quickly, because without that relationship, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah. And it's lovely as well that you can almost have, you know, that bank of therapists that you trust, because I think by you being honest and saying, you know, if we don't feel like the right fit, I've got other people that I can trust, I feel like that would then build a really strong relationship with those clients as well. So that's really lovely that that's been your experience. Yeah. And I know that one of the things that you're quite passionate about talking about, particularly on your blog and on your Instagram, is orthorexia. And I think that was kind of what we were going to chat about today, because I just feel like we heard about orthorexia a few years ago. And then, well, not a few years ago, sorry, it's been obviously around for quite a while, but it kind of came to the forefront. And then I just feel like it's almost not disappeared, but with the rise of like disordered eating and, you know, quote unquote healthy eating or things like that, it's just almost normalized. And I'm very worried about kind of, you know, for people that are struggling with orthorexia, the impact that that's had on them.
Yes. Yeah, I very much share your concerns there. There's one of the problems with orthorexia, and this is something I'm seeing an increasing focus on in the literature, so you know, the scientific literature, as well as blog posts and articles, is this separation between orthorexia and orthorexia nervosa. Yeah, so I'm going to caveat this entire podcast by saying there will absolutely be people who agree with some of the disagree with some of the stances I take, but in turn, I'm not vehemently bound to any of my opinions on this, because the research is so lacking and the opinions are so varied that I don't think anybody can afford to take a definitive positionality on orthorexia. So that's my little caveat. Would it help if we define some terms here?
I think so, yeah. Just in case people listening are thinking, I have no idea what that is, or I've got an idea, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay. So orthorexia is an eating disorder, but it's not recognised officially as an eating disorder, which means it doesn't appear in the DSM-5, which is the biggest sort of diagnostic manual, which has the criteria for mental health issues and disorders. So it doesn't appear in there, so it's not recognized as an official eating disorder. The term's only been around since the mid-90s, but it describes an obsession with healthy eating, pure eating, clean eating, to the point that I'd say it is pathological. But here's where it gets complicated, because people are now separating orthorexia and orthorexia nervosa. So orthorexia being an obsession with clean eating, pure eating, healthy eating, whereas orthorexia nervosa would be the more pathological kind of orthorexia, which has significant impacts on the person's physical and mental well-being. So this is why I think it is difficult and sort of gets to the point you were talking about, which is that it's become normalized, because I've even seen the term healthy orthorexia.
Oh my God.
So that is even being used in the scientific literature. So
what?
I take issue with
by
that.
By who?
I know, right? This is what we're dealing with. You know, that if academics are even thinking of healthy orthorexia versus orthorexia nervosa, we're getting into really muddy waters here.
Yeah.
So of course it's going to be normalized if even academia is normalizing it. So that's where we need to be quite clear that when I'm talking about orthorexia, I'm now having to make it crystal clear that I'm talking about orthorexia nervosa. Because
I'm confused.
Yeah.
Maybe I missed something. What's the difference between orthorexia, orthorexia nervosa, and then healthy orthorexia in this sense?
In this sense, healthy orthorexia and orthorexia are used as synonymously to mean someone that is quite obsessively focused on healthy eating. Orthorexia nervosa would be the focus on healthy eating and the purity of foods, but with all of the other pathological traits and effects that come with that, so impacts on the person's physical and mental health. So healthy orthorexia and orthorexia are being seen as not really a problem.
How are they measuring that though? Like realistically, you know, it's the whole friggin' atypical anorexia and anorexia again. Oh, your BMI is not below 18.5, therefore it's atypical anorexia, and you know, that's not as severe. Okay, well, have they not learned anything? Oh, Jesus, this has made me angry.
I really struggled with this when considering, you know, what to focus on with this kind of topic that you said you wanted to look at, because that could be a discussion in itself. Just the fact that you now have references to healthy orthorexia as distinguished from orthorexia nervosa.
Yeah, because like from where I'm sitting, when somebody has an eating disorder, for so long it's kind of shrugged off as no, it's totally fine, like there's nothing wrong, you know, I'm just like watching what I eat, or you know, I'm just being a bit more healthy or whatever. And in particular with orthorexia, it's so easy to say, oh, you know, I'm just trying to be a bit healthier, you know, I'm cutting out some crap and just, you know, watching what I eat and stuff, just because of the health implications and stuff. Then you go and put a friggin' label on, like healthy orthorexia. Like that is literally giving someone the biggest, and I don't want to say excuse, because I know it's not a choice. However, that would then reinforce this idea that it's okay to engage in these behaviors, and that actually, you know, if you're somebody that's struggling with it, and you're somebody that's got those pathological issues with it as well, then you know, you're kind of weak, because there's people over there that are managing orthorexia and they're healthy with it. So like, why are you struggling so much?
Absolutely. I could not agree more, and I can use a personal example with this, because I did have orthorexia nervosa, now that we need to be that specific. And for me, it was a case of, well, no, everybody else is wrong. Like, I'm eating healthily. I'm looking after my body. Why would you want me to not do that? The problem is with you. The problem is with societal acceptance of eating junk and shit and not looking after yourself. Mm-hmm. That was my shield. And this is one of the big problems with the research. There's so little of it that how can we accurately distinguish whether someone has so-called healthy orthorexia versus orthorexia nervosa when we don't know what we don't know. You know, we don't know how much clinically, you know, how many people out there are suffering with the guilt and anxiety that comes with, you know, breaking rigid food rules, the social withdrawal, the potential, you know, nutritional deficiencies. That there's not enough evidence to be able to distinguish them in that way and have a meaningful conversation around it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's highlighted such a good point of the fact that there's just not enough research around orthorexia, let alone breaking it then down into different categories of, I guess, severity or impact that it's then having on people. And I suppose, because I've always thought about this in terms of similarly things with like exercise and stuff like that, in that where do we actually draw the line of when it's a healthy behavior or when it becomes an obsession that is actually having a really negative impact on your life? Because, you know, in my day-to-day life, I do try and eat quote unquote healthily, whatever that looks like for me. And things like that. But then where is that line of, okay, this is now an obsessional thing? Because if there's now a healthy orthorexia, well, to me, any sort of obsession or fixation or rule or rigidity around food is demonstrated an unhealthy relationship with exercise. The healthiest relationship with exercise is flexibility and being able to adapt depending on what circumstance you're in or the environment that you're in. So if you've got quote unquote healthy orthorexia, that to me is suggesting that there's rules and rigidity there. I just don't see how the word, I just don't think that the words healthy and orthorexia should exist in the same sentence.
No, I completely agree. And whilst I'm very much not one for policing language, I don't like the word healthy to begin with because it's so loaded. No. And again, it's gotten to the point where it's difficult to have a meaningful conversation around what is healthy. But you've hit on a really good point there. From the limited research we have, the majority of people who would meet a diagnosis of orthorexia nervosa, bearing in mind there isn't even a consensus on the diagnostic criteria. people who were very much engaged in sports and sort of pursuits that relate to body composition. So, you know, that would be things like bodybuilding, weightlifting, that kind of thing. So then you also have to take into consideration what is their relationship to exercise. Because you do see over-exercise or unhealthy, I'd be doing air quotes here, relationship with exercise amongst people who meet the diagnosis for orthorexia. So this points to an issue I take with the weird diagnoses of seen overall, in that a diagnosis is not an explanation. It's a description. It's the map. It's not the territory. So when we're looking at, as you said, you know, when is it healthy or unhealthy? When is it obsessional? You can give me 100 people with anorexia. They meet the criteria, the diagnostic criteria for anorexia. And yes, you know, eating disorders are quite predictable. They're not particularly creative in how they present. But I still have 100 different people who I need to work with individually to tailor treatment to their needs, despite the commonality of the diagnosis and the presenting symptoms. So add that into the mix, and we're really, you know, getting into that territory of how do we understand orthorexia, let alone how do we work with individuals who are meeting the diagnostic criteria for orthorexia.
Well, and I think that's the thing that, I mean, I feel like I've had so many conversations and it seems like people really understand this, but we just can't seem to translate it into general practice, not private treatment, in, you know, but like you can have a diagnosis of anorexia, cool, but it's not the diagnosis that you're trying to fix, it's the person, and that person comes along with all of their unique characteristics and their unique experiences, traumas, relationships, you know, beliefs, opinions, da da da, the list is endless. And so one thing that might work for one person will be completely the wrong thing for somebody else. But that's, you need to spend time to understand the person rather than just being like, okay, so you've got X diagnosis, therefore this is the treatment we're going to provide for you. And I guess that's an even more difficult thing with orthorexia, is because it isn't a diagnosis that's within the DSM-5.
Yeah.
There is no sort of clinical guidance on how to treat that disorder. And so I guess that adds an element of, you know, is it real? Is it actually something that we need to worry about? Is it something that people, you know, require treatment for? Because it's not in the diagnostic manual. So, you know, which I would completely argue the side that, yes, this is something that impacts people. If it's having an impact on someone's day-to-day life and their relationships and their work and their mood and everything else, then absolutely it, you know, people deserve treatment for that. Yeah. But I also wonder, because of the normalization of orthorexia, and I think especially in this modern era, it's like, if you're kind of, you know, if you're motivated and driven to follow a certain diet pattern, and where, you know, you don't kind of succumb to eating a slice of cake, or, you know, you're dedicated enough that you can skip breakfast and you can intermittent fast and da 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 da, it's all seen as like really positive attributions. And so I think that's another worry of mine with this new healthy quote unquote orthorexia, of we're already glorifying the behaviors associated with it. Like, I would say that behaviors associated with anorexia are glorified, but when somebody is emaciated and in hospital, people aren't really glorifying that anymore. The only people that are glorifying that are people that are sick with anorexia themselves.
Yes.
But orthorexia, I think because you can appear quote unquote healthy, you can be at a normal weight, you can still engage in activities, but you're almost, there's that superiority complex of, oh yeah, I've actually meal prepped my own food because, you know, I don't eat X, Y, and Z because they're bad for your health. And it does, I think, give people that superiority complex to then put the label of healthy orthorexia on it. It's just,
yeah,
I'm actually mind blown, Craig. I can't lie to you. I can't move on from this.
No, that's fine. It's something I'm struggling to get past myself, because it's on the one hand, it's important that I'm able to communicate what the literature says and what the understanding of eating disorders, what understanding we have of eating disorders, you know, when I'm, whether it's because I'm on a podcast or I'm, you know, speaking with other health professionals or even clients. But actually at the therapeutic level, I could not care less if the person who is sitting in front of me hasn't got a diagnosis, because most of the people I work with don't have a diagnosis. Mm. They haven't had an official clinical diagnosis. And we know that the majority of people with an eating disorder don't meet the diagnostic criteria for anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder. They often fall into the OSFED.
And what do you think about that? Because like, I was having a conversation about this with somebody else the other day, and they were saying, you know, we need to have the diagnostic criteria, and the diagnostic criteria are there as a gateway to treatment. And so often it's like, I need to give you a diagnosis because that's what you need to be able to access treatment. Mm. But as I guess that might be the case in the NHS, but as you've just said, you know, a lot of the people that you work with don't have a diagnosis. So in an ideal world, what do you think that we would like completely tear up the current diagnostics and rewrite them? Or do you think there needs to be a different approach?
I'm very much on the, I won't say on the fence. I'm very much not taking a hard stand either way, because it to go back to that sort of analogy of the map and the territory, I think diagnostic criteria is a very useful map.
Yeah.
And I think you do need, especially with eating disorders, you do need to have a map, but you also need to accept that that map doesn't show you the territory, doesn't show you the detail of that individual experience. So yes, at the level of people being able to access services, then diagnostic criteria is sort of a, I'm going to say, a necessary evil. Because not everybody can afford private treatment.
Yeah.
You know, so the people who were, say, coming to myself or other private therapists are fortunate enough to be able to access private therapy. So in some sense, I want the diagnostic criteria to help people access free services, but I'd rather people just be able to access services for free in the way they could private therapists like myself, who doesn't need them to have a diagnosis, because I can work with whatever the food or body image struggles are that they're bringing and everything that's underneath it, because that's the important stuff, without having any sort of label attached to it.
I think it's a great thing to highlight, and it's fantastic that there are people out there like yourself providing that support, because so many people that need help don't have a diagnosis. And with that in mind, like, how do you work with people if they don't have a diagnosis? Because I am definitely guilty of this in terms of, like, even though I was given a diagnosis of atypical anorexia, it was like, oh, well, you know, I've only had an eating disorder for 14 years. I'm not that sick. Like, I've never been emaciated or hospitalized or what have you. So it can't be that bad. How do you work with people to, like, encourage them, or I guess help them see that they don't necessarily need that diagnosis, and the fact that they're reaching out for support often shows that they're worthy of that support?
Yeah. And I think that's such a pertinent question, because a lot of people do access services like mine with the fear that they aren't sick enough because they don't have a diagnosis. Especially when you do have people who've been told they can't be referred to the local NHS service because they're not underweight clinically. So part of the work, and as a counselor and psychotherapist, this is, you know, the key for me is developing that therapeutic relationship where I can deeply understand their experience on a day-to-day level. You know, what is it they're experiencing around food, whether it's, you know, restrictive behaviors, overeating, binging, purging. What is their experience with these things? How is it affecting them? What kind of beliefs about themselves are feeding into this? What personality traits are we seeing? Perfectionism, for example. And once you start to look at that individual experience, and I'll often look at three things with eating disorders that really help people understand why they have an eating disorder and what's keeping it going. And it's your three P's, your predisposing factors. So what kind of things put you at risk of developing an eating disorder? Mm-hmm. Your precipitating factors. So when did things really start to get bad? When did the eating disorder manifest? And then your perpetuating factors. What is it that's happening that's maintaining these behaviors around food? And once people have those, I find that the idea of a diagnosis doesn't seem as important. It's more about they just want to understand what's happening to them and how and what the way forward looks like. And conversely, I've also seen a lot of people very resistant to the idea of a diagnosis, which is fair enough. You know, the words such as, I don't want a label slapped on me. I don't want to be put in a box. I totally get that and I'll respect that. So I will always ask people, do you have a name for your eating disorder?
It's really interesting about the labels, I think, because I found with my label, it's only been destructive. It's only made me feel inadequate or like I'm, you know, like I mentioned before, not sick enough. And actually, I think it always felt really like it didn't fit for me. Mm. I'd always be like, I don't understand why I've been given this diagnosis because I don't feel like atypical anorexia fits. Mm. And I think that's the case for so many people because, you know, eating disorders don't fit nicely into a box. And so somebody might have anorexic tendencies with binging and somebody might have anorexic tendencies with a focus on muscularity or what have you, or they might have an exercise addiction and bulimic tendencies or whatever. And it just feels so sort of like clear cut that I don't think actually, you know, it really helps the individual. But also, and this is slightly different, but I guess it's another experience of where I've had a diagnosis and what have you, is that when I was diagnosed with ADHD, initially, like in the first week or so, I was like, oh, what a relief. Mm. It makes sense. Like I've got this diagnosis. It's been recognized. It's almost that validation of, you know, something's a bit different here and we can work with it. But since then, I kind of wish I hadn't got the diagnosis because it's now so complicated. And I know that this is just like hopefully a short-term thing, but I've noticed myself sort of fixating on the label a little bit and being like, oh, you know, that's the ADHD or what have you. And actually, you know, yes, I have ADHD, but it's not the ADHD, it's Hannah. Hannah needs to learn to cope differently in order to manage the ADHD symptoms. And this is probably very controversial, but when a lot of people say like I am like an ADHDer, or I don't know, but like you would say I am autistic, for example, I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan of that. And that's just like for me personally, like, you know, you do you, boo, and say whatever you want. But I'm not ADHD. Like I'm Hannah.
Yeah.
And I think as soon as you start saying like I am this and what have you, sometimes also what we can do with diagnostic labels is like that becomes your whole personality. And like really cool if you're like I am autistic and I'm also, you know, a pianist and a friend and da 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 da. But often people kind of have it at the forefront of them. And I'm like, it's great that you are kind of recognizing that and that you're, you know, you're happy about that and stuff, but don't let it define you completely and utterly. And don't let it kind of define, you know, don't let it, things may be more challenging for you, of course, but don't let that be the reason that they're more challenging, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense and echoes my feelings perfectly also as someone with ADHD. I think there are a lot of dangers when we get into the place of identifying with labels because they can be restrictive if that becomes your identity.
Yeah.
And you know, when someone is sat in front of me in my clinic, what I'm interested in isn't any labels that mm-hmm. that they have. It's what those labels mean to them and how they how that manifests in terms of them being able to live their values and have a meaningful, purposeful life.
Mm.
So the label isn't the, you know, when we talk about sense of identity,
mm-hmm.
that for me isn't an end goal. It's a step in reaching mm-hmm. in reaching the goal, which for me is to live aligned with your values, the things that matter to you, so that you can live meaningfully and purposefully.
For sure, yeah. Well, I mean, I think with anything, any sense of identity that is 100% your identity, I don't think is positive. Like, you know, it could be, I could be, oh, you know, I'm a cat mum. As much as I friggin' love my cats and my cats are absolutely amazing, if that was the only part of my identity, I think there'd be a bit of an issue. I think people would be saying to me, Hannah, like getting a bit, you know, claustrophobic, like, you know, you need to have other things in your life. And as amazing as cats are, you need to have that variety.
Yeah.
And I think for me, whilst I said, you know, I wish that I hadn't got the diagnosis, I don't think that's actually true. But I think what the diagnosis for me has allowed, and it's the same with the eating disorder, is that, okay, I have this way of coping with things, or I don't have a way of coping with things, and it's maladaptive. How can I now change it to be supportive? Because I was having a really interesting conversation with my therapist the other day, and she's actually asked me to write a goodbye letter to my eating disorder.
Oh.
And when she said it, I was like, oh my God, like my heart like came out of my throat, and I was like, oh my God, I'm not ready to say goodbye. And then I haven't actually done it yet, and I definitely need to do it soon because I've got my therapy session soon. But when I was thinking about what I wanted to write, it was very much like, you know, people always kind of get mad or angry at their eating disorder.
Mm.
And actually, at the time, I didn't feel like there was anything else in the world that I could do, or there was anybody that I could call on that would be able to help me navigate what I was going through.
Yeah.
And at the time, the eating disorder was there for me. And yes, it made life living hell. But now I'm in a place where I'm strong enough that I can be able to manage things and navigate things without it. And so I think it's the diagnosis allows you to recognize, okay, this thing is here, but now how can we work to a place where I can be strong enough to navigate life without it, and that I don't need it, and that I'm grateful for, you know, the time that it was there when it supported me, but it's not actually supportive anymore.
Yes.
And I need it to go now. And I think that's the same with the ADHD, I guess, is like, you know, the way, I mean, I think it's actually the opposite with ADHD, because it's like that causes the chaos. I mean, this is my perspective, that mm-hmm. causes the chaos. And then Hannah comes in and steps in and says, okay, how are we going to resolve this? But equally, you know, ADHD, like all neurodivergence, has its strengths and has its challenges. So in some areas of your life, it can make you, you know, an amazing at something. But in others, it can be debilitating. And I guess with that, it's like an eating disorder in the sense of it can make you really amazing at things, and it can make you think something's debilitating. However, with an eating disorder, it makes you really amazing at things that probably aren't things that you should maintain in your life.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
Oh, hitting on so many good points here that really resonate with me, because it's the only thing an ADHD diagnosis has done for me is self-compassion. So instead of oh my God, why am I like this, why can't I do things that other people can seem to do easily, like really
mm-hmm.
basic things, the imposter syndrome, all of the stuff that comes along with that, it's made it so much easier to not get consumed with any of that. So that, as you say, Craig can step in and say, okay, yep, struggling to do this at the moment, I understand the reason why, what, if anything, am I going to do about it?
Sure.
And what I don't want, and a friend of mine who also has ADHD and is a therapist, he warned me. He said the one thing you've got to be careful about is getting sucked into the identity,
mm-hmm.
because it's so easy for it to then, become. I mean, he used the word excuse, and I think he was absolutely right. And I'm not saying any individual person will use it as an excuse, but it's very easy to what would the word be, to feel powerless when you've got a label that you're heavily identified with. And therapy especially is all about empowerment, so whilst I personally don't go along with the narrative that ADHD is a superpower, certainly not in my experience, I'm quite, if it is a superpower, I am quite happy to give it up to someone else if they want it, and they I will offer it freely.
Yeah, I think my perspective of it, I mean, I completely agree with that thing. Anytime someone says ADHD is a superpower, I want to be like, well, you want to live a fucking day in my head. because as I said before, it has its strengths and it has its challenges. And yes, when I can use its strengths, it has enabled me to be a very motivated, dedicated, hardworking person. But equally, it has its challenges, and they can be, they can be debilitating. And I actually saw, I was watching a video this morning, because I think on the news this morning they were saying that there's been a there's just not enough resources for assessments and things like that. And Matt Gupwell, who does an ADHD podcast, he was saying I've gotten to the point where I don't want to live anymore because my ADHD is so debilitating. And I think when people say that it's a superpower, they massively neglect that side of things, in that you can be just so overwhelmed and distressed with the fact that you can't cope with life like other people can. And thoughts like that do come into your head. So massively with you on, if someone wants to take it from me, then they're welcome to my superpower.
Absolutely.
But I think the compassion piece is really, really important there. And I think one thing that I have tried to navigate and communicate in the best way, because I don't want it to come across as harsh, but I think it sometimes can, but I literally don't mean it in a harsh way. But I always say to my partner, because he was worried that, because I did use the eating disorder as an excuse of like, I can't eat that. Or I don't like that, or what have you, or like, I can't do that because of my eating disorder. It was never as black and white as that. It was always, lies and underlying stuff, which I think he now has the concern that I'll do the same with the ADHD. But what I try to explain to him is, I'm never going to say like, oh, I smashed that glass because I have poor perception of the world, or because of my ADHD, or, oh, I was running late because I got carried away because of my ADHD. But what I will say is, I'm really sorry. The reason that I was late is because I have ADHD, and that's highlighted to me an area that I now need to work on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the really important thing, is being able to recognize where those challenges come up and then working on them. I think if you use it as an excuse and don't do anything about it, that's where it can become an issue. And I think that's where people get swept into the whole identity piece.
You're so right, and this is why I get frustrated with some of the narratives around ADHD medication, and try all these wonderful things so you don't have to take meds, where
did you see that thing I commented on the other day? That what you're referring to?
I wasn't specifically referring to that, but that did kind of highlight the example I'm trying to give, which is all of these things may help with ADHD, and that's wonderful if they've worked on an individual level. But there's I was a behavior change specialist for the majority of my working life, and I couldn't put into practice so many of the things that I was teaching other people how to do. So, you know, pardon me if I just say, fuck right off with your medication, sorry, your recommendations, while I try a medication that might actually help me put those recommendations into practice, because they haven't worked for me up until now. And, you know, that is my stance on that. I think there's, I think it's so easy to demonize the medication route as a quick fix and that kind of thing. But on an individual level, you don't know how much someone is suffering, even if you have the same diagnosis. Again, it's a map, it's not the territory. Your your experience with that diagnosis is not going to be the same as someone else's. And there's too little nuance with this stuff, and that's where I get really frustrated in, even in the eating disorder field. We need nuance. We can't just be looking at things with generalizations and promising magical solutions, because that will not work for everybody.
Yeah, and I think it brings us back to eating disorders again, doesn't it? In that, you know, sometimes things will have worked for some people, and sometimes, you know, that's never going to work for somebody else, which I think is why we really need to have that individual approach. And, you know, with the whole medication thing, it's such a good point in that sometimes it can get somebody up to a point where they're then able to implement stuff. And I think it's so similar with eating disorders. You know, if somebody is not eating regularly or is, you know, severely underweight, then the first thing to do is to get somebody to establish a regular eating routine, or the first thing is to do is to get somebody up to a certain weight where they can then start engaging in things to work on the psychological stuff, or start with the behavioral change or what have you, rather than just kind of saying, oh, well, you're in treatment now, so you better get started today, and if it doesn't work for you today, then that's it, and we'll just throw in the towel.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's about looking at what tools are available to get you to a point where you can put things in place and engage with things that you otherwise could not do without said tool, which in the case of, say, anorexia would be eating regularly, increasing energy intake. In the case of ADHD, it may or may not be medication. But yeah, I mean, for me, the identity part isn't interesting outside of the, okay, here's an explanation that can allow me to apply some self-compassion, but now I have that knowledge, I want to have the specific methods of treatment that are going to help me to have a higher quality of life. And if that's medication, great. If it's not, fine. But I only want the diagnosis as a signpost to help me figure out the territory so that I can improve things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was a very nice tangent to go down. And hopefully that has helped people. But just to bring us back to orthorexia, just to finish the episode, I guess I wanted to ask you from your perspective. So obviously we spoke about like this new stupid diagnosis that or name that neither of us think is a good idea. But what the hell do we know, hey? So if anyone's listening and they're thinking, yeah, I'm actually really struggling with healthy eating and becoming very obsessional and my exercise patterns and things like that, what would be your best advice for them?
So yeah, this is where it gets particularly interesting, because I think those individuals are unfortunately going to be in the minority, because orthorexia is one of those, call it a diagnosis, that is least likely to have someone reach out for help. So what I would want anybody who recognizes that they do have that relationship with food that is, let's say, quote unquote unhealthy, there is help out there, there is help available, that you can actually develop a relationship with food that is healthful and nutritious, but doesn't require these strict, rigid rules that cause you so much pain, so much anxiety, and so much guilt, that there is a meaningful, purposeful, value-driven life outside of that. And and that, as a therapist, you know, I can speak for many therapists who work with someone with orthorexia, we aren't going to sit there and tell you to just start eating anything and everything, because that is the fear at the bottom of a lot of eating disorders, but in particular orthorexia. And it's the, if I get help, that means letting myself go. Unknown, yep. Because you're associating letting yourself go with just, you know, eating more amounts of food than you would feel comfortable with, foods that you consider bad foods, putting on weight to a point where you just imagine your quality of life diminishing and you being unhappy. And the reality is that there are certain values that drive your orthorexia. And if we can actually get in touch with those values and channel them in a different way, you're not going to let yourself go in the sense that you're going to have more self-compassion. And, you know, regardless of weight gain or allowing yourself to eat food you previously demonized, you can be so much happier and fulfilled than you are right now. That these fears that you have, whilst they feel very real, there is a reality outside of them and a life that you probably can't imagine right now. And I'm speaking both from clinical and personal experience.
Yeah. Do you know, when you were speaking then, I was just like, oh my God, I've come up with like the best quote in the world. instead of letting yourself go, you're letting yourself live.
Oh, I love that. Yep.
I might name the podcast that. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, go with it. Trademark it.
Trademark Hannah Hickenbotham. Oh, amazing. Craig, honestly, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your, you know, your personal and your clinical experience, because I think it's a really refreshing approach to hear when people can have that empathy but also have that clinical experience as well. So where can people go to find out more about you and the work that you're doing?
Yep, so I am on Instagram and TikTok, for my sins, at Craig Lee Therapy. And my website is craigleetherapy.co.uk.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Craig. It's been a pleasure chatting to you, and I'll speak to you very soon.
Thanks so much, Han.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.